Enhance.
Just print the damn thing!
Welcome to the Port Forward Podcast.
Welcome to the Port Forward Podcast, episode number 11, Almost Bitcoin. In this exciting episode, we're going to explain the hash and mod, which are the building blocks for Bitcoin, as well as PSExec and some of the features, as well as the ridiculous enhancing scenes in movies. And Merrick's going to review the Echo the Dolphin guy, as well as...
We have our first listener calling over Skype to share his experience with VMware ESXi. We revisit side channels, a little bit about Zen Server and Telecache, and then... Wait, what's this? Oh, it's a note from the future. I guess Neil says that you actually need a 64-bit CPU to run VMware ESXi. So with that being said, let's get the show started.
All right. Welcome to the Port Forward Podcast, episode number 11. Today is June 30th, and tonight we have a special guest, Neil, who will be joining us in a little bit. But right now, Ben is going to tell us a little bit about hashing. Ben, you there?
All right, what's up, guys? How's it going, Merrick?
Pretty good. How's it going?
All right. So this episode, we're going to talk a little bit about Bitcoin, which I think we're a little bit late to the game. I think that every podcast in the tech circle that I listen to has like the obligatory Bitcoin episode, and I guess we're just lazy or late or something. I don't know. But now we're going to talk about it. But that's going to be later in the show. For now, we're going to talk about some of the building blocks that help make the technology that is Bitcoin. And first, we're going to talk about hashing. So, Merrick and Sam, you guys know what a hash is?
Yeah, we do.
All right. So, a hash function is, basically, you take any length of input. Normally, it's used for passwords, but it can also be used for an entire file. And what it does is it basically jarbles up whatever input you put into it and gives you a fixed length result. And the really interesting thing about hashes is that they're a one-way function. So if you put the same thing in twice, you get the same output. But there's no way to really go from the output back to the input. One example I have is that it's kind of like a meat grinder. So if you put in, you know, a pig into a meat grinder, you know what it looks like. If you put in a chicken, you know what it looks like. But you can't get back to the pig just because you have this ground up meat. You can't get back to what you put in originally. Sam, you also had some thoughts about that.
I find that analogy pretty funny because now I have images.
Well, yeah, I was picturing bacon coming out the other end, and I was like, but I know what bacon comes from. And then I was like, hashing's not like that, but it's okay. It doesn't matter.
But, you know, once you know how hashing works, that sort of kind of makes sense.
And the other interesting thing about hashing is that if you were to change, let's say you were hashing a password, right? If you were to change one letter in the password, the hash looks totally different. Like every single character in the hash is different. Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting how you just change it a little bit and it's totally changed.
And a quick point to those of you who have not heard of hashing before. If you hash the same input with the same algorithm, you will always get the same output. So me hashing my first name, Merrick, with the same algorithm will always produce, you know, a fixed exact output that will never change as long as I don't change the input, which is my name, or the algorithm. And that is where the utility comes in. So you can use it to verify that a file has not been changed, large or small, or that a password is the same. A user types in a password, it goes through a hash, and then that's a way you know that user's password is the same and that is an authentic user now.
And the cool thing about using a hash for passwords is that you can have their password saved on disk without actually saving their password. You just save the hash. And so what that means is you're allowed to authenticate users, for instance, into your Linux system, and you're able to guarantee, yes, that person really did punch in their password correctly, but the Linux machine doesn't know it and doesn't have it saved. And that's important because if someone breaches your server, they don't have a list of everyone's passwords. They just have the hashes.
Yeah, it's pretty clever. That wouldn't do you a damn bit of good.
No, and we'd have to, at that point, brute force it, which means you'd have to try every input going forwards. You can't mathematically go backwards from the hash, backwards to the password. You have to go forwards. So, is A? No. Is it B? No. Is it C? No. And, brute force. We know how long that takes, right? I mean, we discussed that.
Yeah, for all you know, it could be a 400-character password.
Right, and actually to that point, we were talking about padding passwords and how that makes it so much more secure, and that's one of the most beneficial things you can do to protect yourself is by making a really long password. Even if you just pad it out with dots or characters or percent signs or whatever, making it really long makes it take a lot longer to brute force.
Definitely.
Two quick notes. From an administration point of view, storing passwords in clear text, which means unencrypted or unhashed, is a big no-no, which was part of the whole debacle, a little part of Sony's recent debacle when they found out one of their subsidiaries was storing user passwords unhashed, unencrypted, in clear text, because that way that all of those user passwords were just out in the wild then, and obviously users do reuse passwords. As much as it's a known thing you're not supposed to do, it does make life easier.
So. And people do it, right? And so if those hackers breach into a network and they have the person's username or they have the person's email, now they can take that clear text password and try it on their email account or their bank account or, different accounts that they're trying to get into.
Exactly.
Another thing, well one of the ways you can find out if a service is storing your password in plain text, this is not a guaranteed way, but if you reset your password and instead of them sending you a link, they actually send you your actual password back in plain text, that's how you know they're storing in plain text. And you was more of a 90s thing, right? Sorry, Sam, what?
No, I've still seen that happen.
I have too.
These days I've reset it and I'm like, wow, you just sent me that in an email. I'm always a little surprised. Instead of them sending me back a newly generated one. That's what I normally expect.
Right, or links where you can go change it yourself. They send you back the original password, and that's like basically a huge red flag. Not a red flag, that is proof that they're storing it in plain text. Right. So if they were storing a hash, there's no way that they would be able to, send that back to you.
Right. Is it possible that they could have it, encrypted, and then it only unencrypts it for the purposes of emailing it back to me?
Well, right, but the point is that encryption is now a two-way street. So whatever, service or whatever, web page that sends it back to you, the attacker could just visit that web page and change the script a little bit so that, it did a for loop through the entire database, and instead of emailing it back to them, it emailed it back to him. So that's like two little minor changes, and he still has owned the entire password database.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
So to answer your question, Sam, most of the time, no. Is what you're saying. That is very unlikely where there's going to be a two-way encryption used on a password. The proper way, the, industry approved
standard,
way, whatever
exactly.
You want to call it, is hashed.
Right. And if you're going to spend a lot of time, you may as well. Right. Okay.
So, another thing I wanted to talk about as a building block for Bitcoin is the modulus function. Modulus is basically, instead of dividing one number into another, when you take a modulus, you're doing the same thing, but instead you get the remainder. So, for instance, if you were to say, what is 24 mod 7? Well, you know that 7 times 3 is 21, right? And 24 is actually 3 larger than 21. So the remainder from doing that division, the answer would be 3, remainder 3. So if you were to do 24 mod 7, the answer is 3.
So a simple way to think of it is if someone says a mod function, or it's a common programming thing to modulus something, it's kind of like calculating the remainder.
Yeah, it's like calculating the remainder. And there's other ways to think about it. Yes, Sam?
Is there any difference, any actual difference, tangible, between a remainder and modulo?
No, they're actually exactly the same thing.
Really?
Yeah, which is weird that it's
okay,
called
because
now that you mention it.
When was it last
totally
night?
It's totally be called remainder.
Okay, because last night, Ben, when you and I were going over all the foundations of this stuff, You were giving me that big epic explanation. You're like, you can also think of it as a remainder.
Yeah.
I'm like, wait a minute.
I came up with a really random way to think about it. Would
Merrick,
you like me
you
to share
heard
that?
It was
Merrick Sam?
Sure, why not? It was
very
complicated.
No, if it confused him, I don't think we even need to talk about it because it's not going to help our listeners at all.
Probably not. Because it's a remainder. I'm like, okay, let's go. Next thing.
But yeah, no. Yeah.
Good
yeah.
talk.
And so one of the cool things you can do with Modulus is that if you take two unknown numbers, for instance, you have G and you have X. Let's just say these are two random numbers. And if you were to say G to the power of X, I mean, that would be a gargantuan number, assuming that both of those numbers are pretty large. This is part of something we'll explain later. But basically, by taking the modulus of your answer to your really large number, you've kind of reduced the answer down into a known space. So let's say you did this huge epic math, and then you said modulus 1,000. That means that your answer is always going to be 0 through 999. It'll never be 1,000. It'll never be over 1,000. It'll never be less than 1,000.
Right. And you're basically doing the same thing that you're trying to do originally with a hash, which is taking a large
right.
number and then
reducing
it
down to
length.
A fixed space. But a modulus is a more basic version of that, and the cool thing about, or not the cool thing, but the thing to note about that is that if you change the answer, I'm sorry, if you change the source number by 1, let's say you were to add 1 to the source number, you're also adding 1 to the modulus, whereas that is not the case with a hash. You can't increment a hash, the input to a hash by 1 bit, and have the output also increment by 1 bit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a key difference. But both of these are being used to kind of reduce something larger down to a fixed space. And you could use a modulus as a checksum if you wanted to. So let's say you were sending some packets or some messages on TCP/IP or something else like that, and you said, okay, I'm going to add every byte that I send in this message, I'm going to add it into a single number, and then when I'm done, I modulus 1,000 or whatever. That would let you know if all of your messages, all of the bits were sent correctly, right? Because if they change one bit in the sent message, then you'll see that come out in the modulus and say, oh, the modulus doesn't match. Let's retransmit that message.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Great. So now that we've covered some basic math nerd stuff, let's get into listener feedback.
Cool.
We had our user Antonio. He was referring to the fact that Macintosh does not have sort of an alt tab the way that I would want it to. And he mentioned something very, very useful, and that is if you're in a Firefox window, or the Firefox group, I guess, you can do alt backtick. And backtick is that character. It's right to the left of the 1 on your keyboard. And that will let you switch through individual Firefox windows. So technically, if I knew I wanted to get to something in Firefox on my Mac, I could do a command tab and then a command, or then an alt backtick. So I'd have to move my finger from command to alt, which is kind of annoying, but it does allow you to get there.
But there's still no global alt tab type thing.
Right, and no global most recently used, which is what I was really interested in anyways. So
yeah. There's no add-on. I mean, nobody's made
that's
a little add-on.
I mean, I honestly, you know, don't steal my ideas out there. I will murder you in your sleep, but that's what I want to write for the App Store. I want to write in a most recently used add-on for the App Store.
Did you get that in your sleep part?
Well, yeah,
man,
guys, you'll
really
be sleeping,
you.
And then you'll never wake up. So don't try. It's my idea. I oh my God. Registered trademark, Poor Forward Podcast, episode 11, right here.
Registered trademark.
Oh, man. Well, yeah, if you do mention it, I suppose that's something of a trademark. It's not really a trademark, but...
Exactly.
It's a copyright.
Also, he mentions Van Eck Freaking, which is similar to what we were talking about with the CRT exploit. It was a side channel we were talking about last episode. Van Eck is a little bit different, and actually I'm going to wait till our special guest Neil comes on to talk about that, because we're going to maybe talk about a little bit about side channels. So that'll be kind of interesting once we get him on the line.
For a quick recap too, I was curious. We guys talked about before the lack of desktop icons. Like, you can make this happen if you want, or you can bring them back if you want. And I thought that was kind of cool and weird and different.
Yeah. So he was Antonio, I believe, was saying that it was really cool that I did not have desktop icons. He said that was very hardcore. And he was mentioning about different ways to turn that off. And he was saying there was a registry hack to do it, and actually it's a lot easier than that. If you're in Windows XP, you just right-click on your desktop, and you look at the Arrange Icons by, which is a little pop-out, and then you say Show Desktop Icons. And you just uncheck that, and it hides all of your desktop icons.
I can also confirm in Vista, you just go under right-click the desktop, View, Show Desktop Icons.
Right, so it's View for Windows 7.
View, Show Desktop Icons.
Exactly.
So that's cool. I like that. My start bar and all the rest of it still shows up, so I think it'd be kind of cool for another way to make that temporarily go away, and then you would come back up to your computer, and it would use the webcam to identify your face, and then you'd scan your thumbprint, and then and only then would all your desktop icons and start bar come back. It's like a cool local security. That's a little bit of a random tangent, I know, but I just thought that might be cool.
That's pretty funny.
What else do we have here? Van Eck routine. Okay, I was gonna.
Yeah, we definitely just talked about that, but good try.
Well, Sam, you want to tell us a little bit about PS Exec?
Sure, we can get into that. All right, PS Exec is a really nifty little program. It's free now. It was originally provided by SysInternals, which is now WinTernals, right, when Microsoft took them over. And what it enables you to do is execute processes remotely on other computers on your LAN. So one problem that happens to me frequently is where I need to start or stop a service on another computer that I have an issue getting to with VNC. Either the service, like I stopped it and forgot to start it again, or something, somehow I need to get it started. But I do have VNC access to a lot of other computers on my local area network. So by using PS Exec, I can basically tell another computer, hey, start this service, and it will start it.
So, but what provides that functionality that just lets you say, oh, let's just start that over there?
Well, I was looking into it today. I turned up two of my computers, installed PS Exec on just one. It's just an executable. And bring open a command line, and you run it, and you tell it, PS Exec //, use what are they called, UNC paths, to get access to the other computer, and tell it to say run CMD. And when I look through the services of the second computer that I'm now controlling, PS Exec appears in the services, so it's running as a service on that computer. It's not like a hack or anything like that. It uses Windows credentials to log in, so you do need to have credentials of that computer.
So that must be a remote procedure call then.
I couldn't really tell you for sure.
It's a remote procedure call, dude. That's totally what that is.
You're totally for sure because.
Well, I can look it up for you, but.
All right, I have it. So it's in there, and once you're in there, there's several things you can do, and why this is really neat. Let me go through a few things here. Locally, let's say you just have PS Exec running on your local computer and you have no interest in remote accessing another computer network, there's still a few things that you can do. You can set it to open up a program and tell it which affinity to use. You can set affinity with...
Affinity means, by the way, which CPU core you're going to be running this process on.
All right, so for example, I like to use Firefox all the time.
But yes.
It's fine.
It's not as bad as
Chrome,
IE.
Chrome is so much better. Yeah, you're right. It's better than IE, but less than Chrome. Firefox less cool than Chrome. Yeah, well, whatever.
I'm down with Chrome, too, so let's say with Chrome. If you're doing something like anything that uses 100% CPU, 3D Studio Max.
For instance, I'm running Chrome on Wikipedia on a large page. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay, let's say I have that going in the background. I've got Chrome dominating my CPU. So I can't... Merrick, you said that you could barely move your mouse, right?
Yeah, it was...
When that was going on? Yes, awful. So something like that. I've rendered tons of times with 3D Studio where you can't move the mouse. It's so awful. Like, it's just using all the resources. So what I can do... Normally, if you just launch Firefox, you know, it's competing for those resources, so it's going to be horribly slow. But if you're able to use the affinity and tell it, hey, I'd like 3D Studio to stay on, I don't know, Core 1, and I would like Chrome to stay on Core 0, you know, then everything's super smooth. However, you know, Windows doesn't give you a way to do this easily. You have to launch it first, then go into the Task Manager, then right-click on the process, set affinity, then tell it that, and by the time you've done that with...
It could have edited and started a new thread. It could have done a whole bunch of things. Like, you don't even know, right?
It's not... Yeah, it's that, and, like, your mouse is super slow the whole time. This is, like, it's a big process. I mean, so I always had to run myself before I hit the render button. I got to, like, do all that stuff, decide what I'm going to be using ahead of time. If I had known that I could do this with PSExec, I could just make little batch scripts to just run stuff and tell it, hey, every time you load Chrome, load it on Core 3. And always load 3D Studio Max to only use cores, I don't know, 1 and 2. And only keep Explorer on Core 0. You know, you could set all that up. So that's really neat. That's just alone, that's a really good reason to use it.
But the most important question is, can you use PSExec to open and close the CD-ROM drive?
You know, maybe.
Okay,
Ben,
okay.
Maybe.
A little bit back to the listener feedback. Once again, Antonio, that same listener we were just talking about, he mentions that you can use NIRCMD to open and close CD-ROM drives! And I think that's a great point, because we should all be able to inject and eject our CD-ROM drives.
NIRCMD.
If you got nothing better to do at work, opening coworkers' drives would be pretty entertaining, I suppose.
He says you can do everything on remote machines. So it looks like NIR command. I haven't looked into this, unfortunately, but it looks like this is a similar command to PSExec. And a quick note on the PSExec, Sam, is that it is using a remote procedure call to execute things on remote machines. This is something that was built by Microsoft, but you only really see it used in a kind of corporate environments with Active Directory and things. I'm sorry,
right,
Sam.
Right, exactly. All right. So typically, PSExec is, like you said, you're using it in an Active Directory corporate environment. In forensics, to do a live forensic acquisition of a computer, you know, you get a search warrant and they send in a computer forensics specialist, and that guy needs to get control of that machine while it's still on, because maybe it has, you know, encrypted volumes running, it's got sensitive information, and they've probably arrested the sysadmin, right? So obviously he's not going to give you access to the machine, but since it's in a corporate environment, someone does have credentials of an administrator account for that machine. So you would use PSExec to push something called a servlet onto that machine. And that servlet would then get, I'm not sure how exactly it does this, Ben, but it gets an underlying, like, underpin of the operating system. So you have full control of the operating system in a rootkit-like manner. And
like a rootkit, except rootkits try to hide themselves, so it's more like a Trojan at that point.
Well, it is transparent. Like, if you didn't know what was happening, you there's no way.
But it might
know.
Be that, would it be there in control delete, maybe?
I'm inclined to say no.
Okay, well, at that point I would consider it a rootkit. I mean, you could probably find something like that in Process Explorer, right? But I mean, besides that, if it doesn't show up in control delete, I mean, we don't know, we're just speculating, but I mean, that does kind of approach a rootkit at that point.
Right. I'm going to try and do test of this pretty soon.
You talking about the forensics made me think of something that would be kind of cool. If, you know, I couldn't help but think of the CSI shows they have on TV. I've never really watched any of them, but apparently they're a thing. And could you imagine if there was such a show that was actually based kind of about the stuff we talk about on this podcast and, you know, other security-oriented podcasts? That'd be kind of cool, because us three and our listeners and maybe 15 other people on the internet would totally watch the shit out of that show.
That's true.
It also
That's
would be true. Hard, though, unless they put a retarded amount of work into it, to actually have the show reflect things that were happening in real life, because there's always that disconnect between
Well, yeah, there's like disconnect, like with the password thing, where like, you know, the hacker is trying to get into the computer system, and he gets the first character of the password. Hooray, he's got it. Now for time for the second character. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Like with hashing.
So many movies too. You see that it's like slowly working out the code on the little keypad next to the door. It's like 6, 3, 9. The whole time you're like, not sure how that works, but I'm suspicious.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing about password hashing is that either you've got it all the way there or you don't. Like even if they had the password right but they had the wrong case, like the first letter was capitalized but really your password wasn't capitalized, the hash that's returned is 100% different, right? So they can't just like, oh, we locked in the first character. It doesn't work like that.
Which is too bad because it looks so much more exciting when you see that password generating itself.
We're going to have to see if we can't get a hold of someone in Hollywood and work some shit out.
How would the hacker hack into anything? It's too secure.
They could still maybe portray some real stuff. It would just
like
be
like an SQL injection,
arbitrary.
SQL injection and something.
The best bet is to show them just madly going away like 200 strokes per minute on a keyboard and like a bunch of crazy shit happening on screen. That's pretty much
that's what they already do anyways, dude. Yeah. Haven't you seen Hackers? There's the whole montage where like they're typing with their fingers and then their fingers get blurry as they like put a filter on the camera because they're typing so fast.
Which movie is this?
Is Hackers, dude. It's a great movie.
Remind me of the plot of that one real quick.
Keanu Reeves discovers they have like a some kind of Trojan or something, and then it's hilarious because they're looking at the Trojan on the screen and they're looking at it in a hex editor, right? And I guess what they did was for the making of the movie they like erased a couple of the hex values, so it's blank. There's like a bunch of hex and then there's two values that are empty, not there. You can't have a file that just has bits missing in the middle because then the two sides would just and fill up the gap. So
that's
I don't really know.
I gotta watch that. That's not jogging any memories. I guess I don't know
the exact plot, but I'm just telling you the things I remember.
Seems like I thought I'd seen that until you're describing it, and I'm like,
yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah. It's got Keanu Reeves and Angelina Jolie, dude. I'm pretty sure that's an epic movie right there. I mean, you can't beat that.
Is this the one where at the end the bad company is threatening to like, or some bad guy's threatening to like dump the oil tankers in the ocean? Is that the same movie?
Maybe.
Or how about earlier? There's a camera scene where, or whatever you want to call it, where they're like battling it out, you know, digitally, and the camera like does a 360 pan around like their profile while they're going to war. Is that that same movie?
I believe that you're correct. Is empty, so I'm on IMDb, so I can't tell you.
Son of a bitch.
Also, there is a scene in that movie where they navigate through a database in 3D.
Somehow, you know, I think I have seen that movie. I'm pretty sure we're talking about the same movie.
It's worth a rewatch, by the way. Everyone should go watch Hackers for episode 12.
Whole episode to this retarded movie. I do remember, if it's the movie I'm thinking of, I do remember being suspicious when I first saw it before I knew a lot of this stuff, and I'm thinking, I don't know if that's how that really works, but, you know, how many times have you seen movies where you're like, I know that's not how that works.
So, but they did have some good, like, verbiage in
there.
No,
it's
like,
cool that they tried. I mean, you know.
I remember Keanu Reeves was talking, and he was like, oh, yeah, Cisk is so much better. Or, no, Risk is so much better than Cisk. Risk is going to be the new huge thing. And by the way, Risk stands for Reduced Instruction Set, which basically means Reduced Instruction Set Computing, which basically means that you have fewer opcodes in your CPU, and then you put more of them together to do instructions. We can talk about that, but it's awesome. They use like proper terminology for the day, the time, you know. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, is pretty rare since everything was just... Well, they still do it nowadays. In 2005, I worked with the guy who... You mentioned CSI, so I worked with the guy who was the visual effects supervisor for CSI Miami, Mark Lighty. And he was responsible for overseeing all the cheesy effects that they did. And he sort of, you know, he made fun of it a little bit, and he's like, yeah, they're cheesy. But, you know, what are you going to do? It's like TV, and they're always really short on time, and
production.
The truth is, nobody really cares that much. It looks
Except
pretty
for guys
good,
like and us, and we get all pissed about it. Everyone else doesn't give a shit. Two flying fucks, so.
So you're like 1% of the audience. Is you getting all mad?
Yeah, it's just me being
super
rage.
We'll go online in forums and trash talk that TV show for being so gay. Jeez, learn something about Risk and Cis, you complete homos.
And a lot of the effects were, like, they're complicated in theory, but but they're executed in this sort of quick and dirty manner. So, and always, like, the content of whatever we were visual effectsing never had nothing to do with reality. They had all that sort of, like, encoding stuff, and they did my favorite thing, wherever they take security footage and they enhance it. I can't do air quotes. Enhance.
So it's like the enhance thing. It's like zoom in, pan right.
Yep. Super Troopers.
Dude,
enhance.
Dude,
enhance.
There is the most. Enhance. Okay, there's this show. There's this show called Red Dwarf. It's like a super nerdy show that I never watched, but I was online and someone was talking about Blade Runner. And in Blade Runner, they do one of these enhanced things, and one of the comments was like, no, you have to see this scene from Red Dwarf. The enhance is epic. And I've seen it. Basically, what they do is there's a picture, and then like there's like an android robot guy. And so the robot guy is like, scan the picture. And the first thing he says is, uncrop. And the picture gets larger. Like, oh my god.
I might have one that's worse than that.
I don't think, dude, I don't think so. We can I'll put them in the show notes and then we can review offline. It's so bad.
Dude, I'm gonna build an elite uncrop tool that it's just gonna own. So you
okay,
see.
Sam, give me yours, dude.
Okay, mine is in one of the CSIs, can't remember which one, but they had a scene where apparently one of like the child molester, whoever the bad guy was, took a photo. I mean, talking about a physical photo that they acquired from his like building or something.
Right, those have really high megapixels, dude, like up to 27 or 28 megapixels.
Yeah, sure. It's a regular like print, right?
Right, yeah.
5x7 or something.
Right.
But his thumb was over like the lens, like on the right side of the thing. So they gave the photo to the tech department and they said,
we need you
to unblur that thumb. So they scan it and then they unblur the thumb and they say, can you run that print? They run the print,
dude. Red Dwarf is retarded. So after
are you saying they came up with stuff that was behind the thumb in the lens? Is that what you're saying, or no?
Dude, they unblurred his thumb that was in the foreground that was out of focus.
Oh, yeah.
And then ran the print.
I got what you're saying. Yeah, that's equally bad. It's not quite as bad as like can you see what's behind the thumb, but it's still pretty fucking bad.
So no, listen to me, dude. They uncrop the photo, and then they look for reflections. They're trying to see what's behind someone on the photo, but they're holding something behind their back. So what they do is they look at the reflection, right, like on their glasses or something, so they can see across the street. And then from across the street, they see a water droplet on the light post, so they're able to reflect back over to the other side. I guess that doesn't make sense. How many reflections are there? And then on the window, and then they can see the back of the card on the address. It's retarded.
You totally just, and you know, a TV show is one thing, but new movies, they still do this shit. If you look at Taken, awesome freaking action movie, Liam Neeson goes and just wrecks all kinds of shop in Europe and is just the most badass guy ever. And in the beginning, he's trying to find out, you know, who took his daughter, and he does the enhance thing on like a Kodak photo booth in some subway station for like 0.5 euros or something. Enhance. So that's, you know, that's a feature length, you know, however many million dollars movie, and they still did that shit. And then you totally just, the water droplet across the street thing totally made me think of that awesome Tom Cruise movie in the future with the precog psychics.
With the precog, that was a Minority Report, right?
Minority Report. Now, in movies like that, you can get away with some crazy shit because it's so future, you don't know. You don't know
you
about
don't
that
know.
Stuff.
Right.
There could
it's
be
not
future
today.
Tools that could do all that. So, congrats sure. for everyone on Minority Report, and to the people who did that scene in Taken, lick my hairy ball sack. You screwed it up. Oh, man. That's funny.
Very well.
So I guess are we done talking about PS Exec and Uncrop and stuff like that?
Wait, what are we talking about? I thought we were talking about movies and TV shows and all the stupid shit they do in them. We should totally have a movie TV show review episode where we like try to watch all the ridiculous ones and like maybe even catalog them a little bit and say this is the best and worst scenes of this movie. That'd be kind of cool. I don't know how much time it would take and may or may not ever happen, but I like the idea of it.
That is a good idea, Merrick. I do like that idea. I think that would be a lot of fun.
It'd be fun. Yeah, it would be cool, definitely.
We end up with good stuff like that. Those Echo videos that I heard you enjoyed.
Oh man, I did not. I cannot even tell you how disappointed I am in myself for watching about an hour and a half of Echo the Dolphin YouTube today.
I knew it, dude.
That is how much I watched. I like without even looking at how many videos this guy had. I was assuming like there couldn't be that many of them.
There's like 25 or more, right?
Just for
Echo.
I was video Tinder 11 before I finally looked and saw how many there were. I'm like, oh my god. I totally thought I was getting near the end of this game. I had no idea. But that guy is funny, to his credit. Like, it's funny how he tones it down, too. Like, he, like, learns to control his rage, and he's, like, less aggro in the later videos. And someone even comments in one of the videos, like, dude, stop. It's not as fun anymore. Go back to the way it was before. Like, seriously, don't listen to all these haters in the comments. Just be yourself in rage. And it was so funny, the little response.
Dude,
but in the beginning videos, he would get so pissed, and the you know, fuck my life, I hate this game, I hate this dolphin, I hate my life. It's so funny. And it's like, he's said that more than often, you know, a bunch of times, and like, there'd be just these little simple things. And what it does highlight, I don't know if he ever actually espoused this in the later videos, or, you know, put it into words, but the game itself was hard to control. That was one of the main problems of Echo the Dolphin, was the controls were kind of fucked. And, like, you know, I'm not saying this guy's the authority, and he probably maybe could have done a better job than he did at playing the game, but still, you know, it is one of the harder... Reading about the game online, you'll see that people tend to agree that this is one of the harder games that has existed as far as playing.
I'm a big fan of some of the sound effects, like the sonar sound effect and things like that. Those are really cool. Mm-hmm. Like, I wish I could have clean samples of you know, Echo the Dolphin, so I could, like, remix that or just make a cool little sound bite or anything, you know. It's kind of something that I'd like to have going on.
I totally remember back in the Genesis days thinking, like, oh, that game looks fun, I want to play it, and I'm thankful I never got around to it after just seeing these videos now. Because
you would be,
so
like,
pissed.
4 years developmentally behind
you
are now.
Seriously, yeah, no, I mean, Sonic was perfect for me as far as all that was included there. I'm not even saying Sonic's a hard game, I just, you know, I love the shit out of Sonic, and I played the shit out of every Sonic game there was, and it sucked too, because the downfall of Sega was, like, painful for me. Like, that's how much Sega I was. I was, like, you know, a fanboy. Like, what, the Dreamcast? And, like, oh, forget your Mario Brothers shit. And then, like, you know, that was the beginning of the end. It was all downhill from there. And I was like, god damn it. Watching Sega just completely nosedive into whatever arcade obscurity they're in now, it just pisses me off. Because
do they still make stuff?
I have to say yes. Not that I know or played anything.
You know, I think actually I remember someone working for them doing game reviews. So I think they do something barely.
They sure as hell,
but
they
not like they were.
They don't do it like Nintendo or Sony, obviously. Like, I totally remember. What was it? The original PlayStation coming out, and I was like, no, Sega CD owns PlayStation. And I was so wrong. That was such a fanboy, I wouldn't see it any other way. So funny.
No, you weren't having any PlayStation.
Yeah, exactly. No, and then I'd go over to my friend's Jared house, and we'd play PlayStation and Gran Turismo, and I'd be like, god damn it. I think Sega CD was out before, without me looking right now, PlayStation 2, so it was like, well, you know, PlayStation's more advanced because it didn't come out till later. That was probably like an excuse I used, I don't remember. But obviously,
Sega released,
we all know how that turned out.
Of,
go on.
They released a version of Sonic the Hedgehog for the Xbox 360 relatively recently.
Oh, god.
When I say relatively, so I mean, like, I don't know.
I mean, I guess I haven't played that one, but I can't imagine it was anything remotely good.
Yeah, I want to say, like, 2009 or something. Mm-hmm. And my friend showed me the gameplay, and, you know, because the stills look really good, you know, the graphics.
It was like Sonic 3D, right? It was, like, over-the-shoulder 3D?
Yeah, yeah.
And you're rolling forward, and the camera goes forward as you roll forward, right?
Right. Just the surprising thing is that they just called it Sonic the Hedgehog, and it was a new thing that they're releasing, so I was surprised to hear that. So, when you play it, I mean, it played like... It was awful.
I fully believe the
graphics were really bipolar. Like, there was this weird thing where you're playing... I don't even know how to say it. It felt like a Dreamcast game. Like, it's got that sort of, like, weird gameplay, like, lots of delays, lots of talking, really long load times. I'm like, what is the point? Like, what am I doing? Like, you don't know what the hell is going on. I'm like, what is the point? Why am I walking around?
If you would be like, you know, which hell would you suffer through, or what's worse, to play a game like that forever, or to play a game like Echo Forever? You know, what would you choose? It'd both be terrible, but it's just...
Are you talking about, like, Purgatory, where you're stuck in front of a console?
Video game hell. What video
with, like,
game
nails
would you take
shot through
your
feet
your
to the floor, and you're just stuck there with the controller glued to your fingers?
That's what we're talking about.
I remember a clue that was, like, I couldn't ignore, even though I was a Sega fanboy, a clue I couldn't ignore was when the first Sega 3D, whatever it was, came out, and that was on Genesis. And what was the first Mario 3D? It was on 64, right?
Yeah, it was Super Mario, called, or I don't know, Mario 64.
Yeah, Super Mario Brothers or whatever it was called. Like, that Super Mario, that was like a seriously awesome Mario game. I remember playing
that.
Yeah,
that was one of my favorite games.
This is so cool, and I can't believe Sega came out with that garbage they did. That's like the first time I was like, fine, I see how it is, Sega. You do me like that. After all these years, you do me like that. I was pissed. And, you know, down the road, I realized full well that the Dreamcast was on its path after, you know, so many games, and it was a slow and painful ending to a Sega relationship for me and them. Just funny shit.
Nice. So I want to get into our next subject, or our next topic. Actually, the term is section, to our next section. But before we get there, I'd like to say that people have been commenting on our website, basically, you know, giving us really good feedback, and we are kind of trying to do something new here at the Port Forward Podcast. We are trying to bring our biggest fans on to give a tutorial. So basically what that means is that if you like the show and you are a fan, and also you are good at technology, basically we'd like you to prepare, you know, a little 30-minute demonstration of something that you know, that you like, something that's a little bit, you know, maybe people haven't heard of, and if we like it, we will fully have you on the show and interview you. That being said, let's get to our next section, which is our interview with Neil. Welcome to the listener feedback section, or listener interview section. We've got Neil on the line, friend of the show, Neil. How's it going, Neil?
Hey, it's good. How are you doing?
Just fine. And what time is it there, man?
12 minutes past 7 in the morning.
So are you getting up just because of us?
Oh, yeah. You made me wake up extra early.
Wow.
If you hear snoring, just kind of mute the line and
leave me on my own. All right, we'll just kick
you
off. No problem. We'll just hang up on you. Don't worry about that. So we had you on, Neil, to give us a little demo or demonstration about VMware. So you want to get started on that?
Yep, can do. Just a bit of background. I started using VMware several years ago as the free server they gave out. Nothing special, just playing with it. Started in my current job about 4 years ago. Little bit of a mess, and wanted to start tidying up. And it was shortly after that the ESX came out for free.
And that is so, like, their management thing, right? Like you.
Yeah, ESX is their top of the line VM virtualization product.
Okay.
And the one they give out for free loses some features, but it still works pretty well. So I started playing around with that, putting the less important systems onto it, and just over time it snowballed, and I've now got to the point where I've got three fairly powerful servers running VMware, about a dozen virtual machines running in those.
Okay.
So I've kind of gone through everything from the basic free scratching hardware together, trying to get something going, to having a fairly decent system.
Okay.
All on quite a tight budget.
And I just to interrupt you a little bit, when you install, what's the install process like? You blow away a whole computer, right? You just need one hard drive and blow it away completely, right, at that point?
Yeah, well, there's two ways of doing it, which confused the hell out of me when I started. There's ESX and ESXi. ESX is a standard application that you install on top of Windows, and you just run virtual machines in a window on that computer.
Mm-hmm.
The ESXi is basically a whole operating system, so you just install it on bare metal. It's got its own drivers for all the hardware, so you've got to make sure the hardware's supported. But it's got a really small footprint. The whole install CD is 300 meg, most of which is client libraries and things.
And how quick does that install?
Oh, haven't done it in a while, but it's minutes.
Minutes, okay.
You can easily have it installed and on the network in 20 minutes, I'd say.
Okay. And one last question is when you install it, do you get local storage? Like, does it just come up immediately with local storage? Or do you, like, if you were to put a new drive in, what would you have to do to add that as local storage?
When you install it, it detects local storage and just sets that up as a data store. Data store is the term that VMware uses for somewhere to put the files for virtual machines. If you add any hardware or you want to connect it to any iSCSI or SAN storage devices, you do that manually, but that's just a case of going to the storage bit of the management interface, adding a storage, saying what it is, formatting it, and you're done. So it's not too complex once you know where in the options it is. But that's all I've done. I've only got local storage on each computer.
So no shared storage for you?
I haven't got any shared.
Okay.
No. I have actually played with FreeNAS to get a iSCSI share going just to see how it works, and it worked fine, but because I was using old desktops, performance was not quite good enough to use properly.
Yeah. Cool.
But yeah, I mean, if anyone's interested in doing virtualization, I know there's the Hyper-V, there's loads of other options. If they look at ESX, they can just get a reasonably recent computer. There's some hardware requirements you've got to meet. Install ESX on it, use local hard drives, and you're away with virtual machines.
And is there like a management console you connect to from like your desktop somewhere, or?
Yep, when you install the ESX, you pretty much can only give it a password and an IP address at the local machine. Mm-hmm. If you browse to that IP address over a web browser, it pops up with a little basic management page that lets you download a proper client.
Mm, okay.
And then you can use that client to create virtual machines, view the desktop of the virtual machines, manage them, see how performance is doing, all that kind of thing. And that works quite well. I've never had any problems with the client. It's Windows only, unfortunately. But it works well, doesn't have any issues.
Great. All right.
And so installed on XP. Yep.
So do you guys have maintenance windows? I mean, what do you do about backups for, you said you have 12 VMs running on just one of your ESXi systems? I mean, how do you deal with all that?
Yes, the backups, we use a product called Veeam.
How do you spell that?
You can, it's V-E-E-A-M. I'll give you a link to put in the show notes if
Great.
You want.
Thank you.
But there's a couple of ways of doing things. Any of the major backup programs, Backup Exec, Veeam, there's a dozen other ones, supports VMware, normally through an agent that you have to buy that lets you connect to the machines. Veeam is pretty much the same, except that they specialize in virtualization of VMware, and they've just started doing Hyper-V as well as one of the systems they can backup from. So whereas with Backup Exec you have an agent for Exchange, you've got an agent for SQL Server, you've got an agent for all the rest of the bits, Veeam jumps in at the virtualization level and just backs up the whole virtual machine.
Ooh,
which makes it nice and simple to do backups, because you just start up the Veeam, say, I want to back up that machine, that machine, that machine, that machine, and it will go and do it.
And also restores are probably pretty easy, right? Because you just make a new VM, or you just basically get a whole, it just appears.
Yeah, restores, you can just get a new VMware ESX server, can be completely different actual hardware, it doesn't matter. Connect Veeam to it, tell it to restore. Downside with Veeam is you need to have, as well as having the Veeam software, you need to have an actual VMware paid subscription. Because one of the things that the free ESX doesn't give you is the remote management, data backup, that kind of side of things.
So with no remote management?
You've got remote management, but you haven't got the access to the API.
Wow.
So you can't have a backup. You can log in. With the free one, you can log in anytime you want and back up a virtual machine. The trouble is, in order to do that properly, you need to turn the virtual machine off, back it up, and then turn it back on again.
Okay.
So it basically, the free one will let you do everything, well, almost everything that you want to do in terms of virtualizing, but in terms of managing it, people, you just can't use it in a production environment for big systems.
Yeah.
You also haven't got the rollover, so if one system dies, it automatically starts using another one.
Yeah, you were going to say disaster recovery, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, disaster recovery is a lot easier with this, because you normally, if you had disaster recovery, you'd have to find a new server, install the OS, patch the OS to roughly the same version, install all the applications, get the data, restore the data in, try and check all the settings are the same. That's with virtualization, madness. Yeah, it takes ages, and it can be done. That's how people are doing it for years. But with VMware, you can just have the virtual machine image you've backed up, install ESX on a machine, restore the VM, and it's back exactly as it was, all the settings, everything, to when you last did the backup. It just makes all the whole disaster recovery much easier, much quicker. The downside is that you're not backing up the data you need, you're backing up the whole OS. So backup tapes or online backup storage systems tend to get a little bit bigger.
You guys,
because of course you've got back all the Windows system files. Sorry?
Do you guys use tapes?
Yes. We still use tapes. We use LTO3 tapes. So they're about 400 gig or 800 gig compressed.
Wait, tell me that story that you were telling me when you first got there about the tapes.
Yeah, that was fun. I should have known there was a few issues because after I got offered the job, I asked just to send me any system docs or network diagrams just so I could get up speed before I started. And the response was basically, yeah, we'll add that to the list of things you've got to do. I turned up and the backup system, I asked the previous IT guy what was happening with backups, and he just said, yeah, it was all done. Some guy that left a year before I started sort all that out, and the current guys are managing and maintaining it, it's all good, just ask them, they know exactly what's going on. When I actually looked into it, only one of the servers had a tape drive in it, a tape in the tape drive. That server had been backing up for the last year and a half or so to the same tape every single night. And that tape had died about 4 or 5 months previously. For the last 4 or 5 months, every night it's been backing up and saying, error, unable to write to tape device. So it was... I mean, the systems generally weren't that bad. There were no specific problems. Antivirus and firewalls were all up to date. But a lot of other things like backups, Windows updates, server updates...
So did you say that was about 4 to 5 months ago, or did I... not get that right? Or when did you start?
I started here about 4 years ago.
Okay. So you have it squared away now, right? You got it all humming perfectly.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yes. And going back to the backups, we are still using tape. I would like to switch to online storage for backups just because it simplifies everything. But given that we've got the tape drives, the tapes, it's an extra cost that we wouldn't have otherwise. We can keep using our current backup and it's not costing us anything. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we switch to online storage, you start to get the fees for the storage and bandwidth and all the rest of it, which add up quickly.
How long do those tapes
last?
We
just take tape. I'd say probably about 2 years. Is what I'd recommend.
You just keep overwriting until you see an error in the log, I'm guessing, is that how it works?
Yeah, well, that's what I did. We use one tape for each day of the week, so we've got a Monday tape, Tuesday tape.
Yeah, you rotate.
On Monday night, back up to Monday tape, take that off-site, so it goes home, I put it in a cupboard at home, and then I bring it back the next Monday. So each tape's written once a week, and they lasted about 3 years before I started getting rare and completely obscure errors. Changed the tapes and they was all fine again. So I'd say after 3 years I started having problems, so I'd probably change the current tapes after they've been in for 2 years. And they don't cost that much. Can't remember what they are, but they're for five tapes it's a couple hundred pounds.
For 400 and 800 gigs, you know, they don't cost much. So
yeah. Especially compared to the charges for online backup.
Yeah.
So So we take the tapes off-site each night. That works fine. Another beauty of the Veeam solution is that Veeam doesn't back up to tape. Well, it's not really a beauty of it, but it kind of works for us. It backs up to a hard drive. And then I use another program just to dump those backup files onto the tape. and Veeam keeps a backlog history with the change logs of all the backups. So if I ever need to restore anything, I haven't got to bother about loading a tape in, searching through it, getting a file, loading out the tape, which can take ages with spooling the tape. Just go to the Veeam management console, say I want to restore a file from that Veeam, search in the VM, find the file, say stick it on that hard drive, and it's done pretty quick.
And that's important, though, because a lot of times, or my stepfather used to work at Sun Microsystems, and they were doing the whole offsite backup thing, and they kind of put their tapes or whatever in a truck and then drove them to offsite because it was like a much larger thing. And my stepdad ran into a problem where, you know, there was a bug and they needed to restore from backup, and the only copy of the backup was offsite. Right? I mean, it's very important when you have off-site backups that you keep them on-site, too. And it sounds like Veeam, you know, just keeps them in its little hard drive there for you, so you don't have to worry about tapes until you really need something, like a really big deal, to go to tape, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, what I tend to do is back up all of the latest days, full backups to the tape, and just take that off-site, just so I've got an off-site copy. But in terms of restores, I would just use a local, unless the building burnt down or something like that that needed the offsite.
Right.
I'm hoping that doesn't happen.
Yeah. That's always something
could
to think about.
A bit of a nightmare.
The building could collapse. A building could burn down. You know, I don't know if you guys have earthquakes. Are you in London or England right now? Or?
Yeah, I'm in Guildford, so just a bit south of London.
Okay.
And we're pretty much immune to earthquakes in this country.
I guess Californians, we're just paranoid about that stuff.
Yeah, well, you are on a little bit of a fault line over there, aren't you?
A little bit of
But we have that sunshine thing here too, Neil, right? I got to give you a little bit of crap about that because I am absolutely in love with your country's television show, Top Gear. I cannot get enough of that stuff. And that's how I've become, you know, slightly intimate with the weather systems over there is by watching Top Gear. And they love to complain about the weather, so that's the only reason I know about it, anything about your country. But again, random side note, I guess your guys' summers are kind of like summer, but it depends. Or
yeah, I mean, perfect example today, glorious sunshine, probably going to be about 20-21 degrees Celsius out there. Nice warm summer day. 2 days ago, we had a massive great storm. Lightning bolts falling, and in the middle of all this flashing and crashing, the intruder alarm started going off.
Oh, no.
And it took us 2 days to get this intruder alarm back working because the lightning had fried the circuits in the main control panel of the intruder alarm. So when you hear weather in the UK, yeah, it changes that fast, and it's completely unpredictable. We could be having another storm like that beginning of next week.
Do you guys
hopefully
have weather
probably won't
at that point to predict, or if it's unpredictable?
Yeah, it kind of goes out to 5 days, but the 5-day forecast, you kind of rely on it, but you never expect it to be 100%. At 5 days, they're often saying it's going to be really sunny and it's actually raining, or vice versa. So you just get used to weather being interesting.
Nice. Okay, I have another question for you. You said that you were not using shared storage or using local storage on your VMware machines. So
yeah.
was that you had 12 VMs across three hosts? Was that correct?
Yeah. That's the biggest two of those VMs are probably Windows Small Business 2003 and a PostgreSQL database server.
Okay. And do you worry about being able to migrate them or not running out of RAM, or kind of how do you manage that?
Yeah, it's a bit of a issue because it's all on the local storage. You can't move it as easily. If we did have a shared storage, you could just go into the VM console. We've got the cheaper version of VMware, so we can't move things live. We'd have to turn it off, move it, and then turn it back on again. But with shared storage, that would literally be a case of turning it off, disconnecting from one VM, telling another VM to connect to the shared storage for that virtual machine, and turn it back on again. So a minute or two downtime.
But it can move, though, from one shared to the other. I mean, from one local to the other, then, with it off.
Yeah, if you turn it off, I mean, you can basically just do a backup. So turn it off, do a backup of it, restore it to another VM, turn it back on again. One of the big problems with VMware is the network or the network stack for accessing the data store. The network for the actual VMs is brilliant. The network if you're doing using the next version up and using the vMotion stuff to move from one storage device to another, really nice and fast, exactly what you'd expect. If you just log on to it and say, I want to download that file, you tend to get about 5-10 megaseconds as the most possible over the network. And that's with decent hardware, gigabit network connections, the work. So it's a known limitation of VMware, and I'm not quite sure what they're doing about it. That problem was there in 3.5, it's still there in 4.1. So I guess for most of their big customers that they care about a lot, they're using the next version's app, and then they've got the shared storage, they can use the vMotion, everything moves around in seconds.
Very cool.
So is it a small price jump, or is it pretty significant to move up to these options?
Oh, it's pretty significant. I mean, the cheap version, which just gives you you're allowed to use up to three servers with two cores, two processors in each server, 256 gig of RAM max, that kind of spec. So it's enough for most offices. That costs about $500. So that's not much at all.
And that's a one-time charge?
Yes, and then there's a support charge, which I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's not too much. It's still kind of $100, so easily affordable, especially for what you get out of it. If you want to start using high availability and vMotion, so running virtual machines moving between servers while they're still live, you need the shared storage of some kind, of course. That jumps to about $3,500. And when you want to start scaling out beyond that, using the even more advanced features, more than three servers, then you start to get into multiple thousands of dollars per server.
Wow. Gotcha.
So it really does. And on top of all this, of course, you've got the cost of the hardware.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to use a SAN, okay, that's going to be another few thousand dollars for a decent SAN that can cope up with it. If you're paying that much, you probably want to get two, so you've got some redundancy in case one dies, because otherwise you've just lost all your virtual machines in one go. You need the extra servers, you need the faster networking kit to use that. So,
yeah, not to interrupt you, but SAN is Storage Area Network, and what that means is that you've got separate network cards and separate routers just for your storage data, so that all your storage packets don't conflict with your service packets, and anyone logging into the machine is logging in on a different network card than all your storage packets and things like that.
Yeah. That's how you should do it. You can keep it on. We've got our management network on our main LAN. Because we're not using shared storage, it hasn't been a problem.
Okay.
And you can do that if you don't care about performance too much. You can keep it simple and just have one network for everything. But yeah, SAN is basically industry spec shared network hard drive. So the same as kind of a Drobo box or one of those shared storage devices, just beefed up.
By the way, guys, Drobo is very nice, but do not try to run virtualization on Drobo. It is a mess. Just putting that out there.
Yeah, you wouldn't get much performance out of it.
You wouldn't get any performance out of it.
So that's a, what, like a processor limitation, right?
That's like a, I don't know what the limitation is, but it's awful. Don't try it. Let me say again, do not try to do that.
Did you, just out of curiosity, how much time did you spend trying that?
I don't even want to go into
no,
it.
No, tell me. It'll make hours, me feel better about the hour and a half I spent watching Echo the Dolphin video game replays today on YouTube. So it'll
probably over 100 hours.
Okay, cool. Just checking. I feel better now.
Okay, good.
Neil, so you use, I heard that you mentioned Small Business Server 2003. Is that what you said?
Yep. Yeah, I've got Small Business 2003.
Okay. What do you guys use that for?
Pretty much just the email and Active Directory. So domain integration, passwords, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Sorry,
when you say email, Is that integrated? I mean, are you pushing stuff out to like Outlook on the? I mean, what kind of email? I'm just sort of trying to figure out what kind of email I'm talking about.
Hey, no problem.
Hey Sam, in contrast, what are, do you guys run anything like that in your operation?
Sam, are you talking
to him? Hi Sam, my name's Mary.
Did he fall asleep?
Nice to meet you. In contrast, I was curious, Sam, do you guys run small business at your place of business or no?
Oh no, definitely not.
What do you use?
We got XP, 7, and Vista, and that's it. And as far as email, it's just Gmail, and then my boss insists on using Eudora.
Is that like a crappy version of Thunderbird or something?
Dude, Eudora is old school. It was like super
email.
Popular back in the old Netscape days. What did you say, Neil?
That's email, isn't it?
Yeah.
Eudora? Sorry, I was a bit distracted just then. The cleaner just walked in and got slightly confused because I'm here early.
Gotcha.
Did you sabotage their vacuum cleaners?
No, I was going to, but I thought that was a bit cruel. I was going to take the fuse out of the vacuum just so they didn't make too much noise. But
that's okay. Tell her she can keep her job this time. So
yeah, well, I'm in the MD's office as well.
Oh,
so I've kind of, because I thought I'd sneak in here and shut the door.
What's,
so quiet,
what's the
though.
Translation on? Is that like CEO or?
Yeah, managing director. So it's
okay,
kind
gotcha.
Of the big boss.
The big boss. The does big, he have a boss. Nice desk and chair, or what's it like in there?
He does. It's a very nice desk and chair. He's got the traditional little printer strapped on the desk, so he can print out confidential stuff.
Cool.
Pretend he's working? No, don't tell him to say that.
The odds of your boss hearing the show are pretty unlikely, but, you know, on the outside chance, he knows you're kidding.
yeah, he does. He's off to the Goodwood Festival of Speed today, so he's probably right now just pulled up in a car park full of lots of very nice cars.
Man, do you know what he drives or what he has?
He's got a Mercedes. Don't know what type, unfortunately, but he was telling me yesterday about his old cars. He used to have a TVR.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're... You know about TVRs over there. They're not exactly a big manufacturer.
I mean, you know, through Top Gear, I'm a little bit cultured as far as cars are concerned, but I've got a very short attention span, and I think we're supposed to be talking about Small Business Server and...
An email.
This is true.
The email you guys run on it.
yeah, well, Ben can cut that bit out. Small Business Server, pretty much just email the exchange. It was there when I started, well, it was there as 2000 when I started. I just upgraded 2003. I'd love to switch to an open source alternative, but I'm not quite convinced there's any good enough at this point.
I don't know. I mean, if you're just doing email, you can just do postfix, but that means that you can't use, Outlook on everyone's computer. And the thing that's really nice about Outlook is that you can do, I mean, email, both you know, Linux side and then the Outlook side do email, but Outlook does business, like meeting rooms and stuff. So you're allowed to define a resource like a meeting room, and then you're allowed to say, I'm going to be using this meeting room from 2:00 to 3:00, and then, you know, are you free on your schedule? I want to bring you into this meeting and things like that. And as far as open source alternatives go for that, there's really nothing you can do. So if you're using something like that, you're out of luck.
Yeah, and there's just enough people using it in the building that they wouldn't want to change.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely two different sides of that to consider. There's the administrative side, which is your end, and what you would have to do to get everything to work like before. And then there's the user side, which is usually a bigger nightmare to get everyone to do something different. That would be just an indescribable amount of work.
Yeah, people don't like change.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Although they like upgrades. If you can pitch as an upgrade, they normally like it. But if they think it's just a different version of the same thing, they don't like it.
So, Ben, just to clarify, the the virtual server you run is different than the one we've been talking about, right?
So what I've been running is I've been running Zen Server, and I am using the free version of Zen Server. So I was very interested to find out what the free version of VMware does. A couple of the differences are, it's very similar. You install onto a bare metal server, and the install takes about 7 minutes, which is great. But the thing that's kind of annoying about Zen Server is that if you don't know Linux, like, it's really hard to do a lot of things. Like, for instance, if you want to add a local storage, you have to go into Linux, format the new drive, set it up as an LVM, whatever, member, and then tell Zen Server, hey, here's an LVM group I want you to use. Whereas you can't really do that from the interface. So Zen Server really brings you back into the Linux. Like, you're in SSH a lot. But another similarity is that it has a management interface that only runs on Windows. And if you're using the free version, you can't do backups very easily. But if you're using the free version, you can do the motion thing. I mean, assuming you have shared storage, you can motion from one server to the other without paying for any of the software. So that's kind of like basically a rundown of the differences between those there.
Gotcha. And we mentioned there was another product or two in this exact same marketplace that does similar things.
KVM is another free one from Linux, but because it's all free all the time, there's not as much support and there's not the enterprise backing behind it. I don't know, Neil, what else is there?
The other main one I can think of is Hyper-V, which is the Microsoft one that you get free with the server.
I wouldn't trust my infrastructure running on Microsoft. Although one thing I will say is that Zen Server is coming out with a new version. Right now they're at 5.6, and the next version is going to be called Boston. I don't know how they went from numbers to towns, but whatever. and in Boston, there is support for integrating into the Microsoft Hyper-V, such that with Hyper-V, if you have Hyper-V running, you can manage a Zen Server, a VMware, and a Hyper-V servers all in one interface. And I don't know much about it, but it's really cool because for big shops that have kind of different virtualization setups, everyone is now plugging into Hyper-V. And really what it means is you can migrate out from one into the other. Basically, people don't vendor lock. So if I started with Zen Server, I can migrate to VMware pretty easily, and I'm not vendor locked. And that is a big selling point kind of for the virtualization world.
Wow. So what was the root the product there in that scenario you just described?
Hyper-V is the Microsoft one, and they have their own virtualization suite, but their management console, very soon their management console will allow you to control VMware, Zen Server, and Hyper-V all together.
Okay, that's what I thought. I just wanted to clarify. That's cool. And so, yeah, it's funny you mentioned the trusting the Microsoft thing, because it's kind of a way of thinking. It's similar to the whole scripting versus programming topic earlier. You know, if you're used to thinking in a Microsoft way or running Microsoft software, it's not that big a deal, and you're used to the arbitrary, obscure errors you may or may not receive and how to sometimes approach those. But if you're not used to it, then it can all seem very frustrating if you're used to the Linux side of it, because, you know, everything is Linux-y, if that makes any sense. Your problems are, you know, fewer, and they're maybe more approachable, and, you know, you're a command line whiz anyway, so who cares? You'll get in there and find out what's going on and update it, patch it, whatever you need to do, make it work.
So, Neil,
interesting.
How are we doing on time? You have, like, 15 minutes, kind of, or what's going on here?
I'd imagine I've got 45 for people to start turning up, but the boss is out today, so I can stay here until 9 o'clock, another hour and 15.
Check in that desk and see if you can find a spare set of keys for the Mercedes in case you want to borrow it. I'm just kidding.
I don't think he'll have left it, but I'll check.
Just in case, you never know.
So are there any more VMware topics you'd like to cover, Neil? I guess logins.
Just going back to what you were saying about... I mean, logins, if you've got the completely free version, you've only got a local user account. So you haven't got multiple users and all the rest. It's not integrated with anything. Mm-hmm. As soon as you pay for the first version of VMware Essentials, which is just $500, you can then integrate the vManagement side with Active Directory.
Okay.
So you're... domain admins on Windows get access to the whole Veeam thing. they can do whatever they need to.
And that's interesting, though, because Active Directory is running inside a virtual machine, but it's giving you authentication to log into the hypervisor, which is outside of a VM.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got the Active Directory running on a machine in VMware.
So weird.
And it's using that to... Yeah, it's kind of a bit backwards, or a bit kind of convoluted, but it works fine. Once you get your head around the fact that it's virtualizing and the virtual system is completely separate to the virtual machine hosting machine,
yeah,
it works quite well.
Yeah. Yeah, please, Neil.
I was just going to say, the problems you get with VMware, and I'd imagine any virtualization system, is that the servers start to take over. I swear, they start breeding. Creating a new server used to be a case of buying a server, getting it, installing it, patching all the rest of it. With virtualization, you can right-click, clone virtual machine, you've got another one. And it just becomes so easy. I tend to have a virtual machine running a very small job. So I've got one little Linux virtual machine running our internal intranet site, which is just a tiny little Joomla install. I've got another virtual machine running a little web chat program for helping customers on our website. And these are all completely separate virtual machines, because it means you can do whatever you want to the web chat and it's not going to affect any other system.
Right, that's really important.
Whereas when
you've
got
to
buy...
I mean, that's kind of the reason that a company would go into a virtualization environment at all, is because you can separate every single service into its own virtual machine, such that if that service gets hacked or if that service goes down, you can take it down without affecting the rest of your business servers.
Yeah, you can make everything completely independent. It's not quite as beneficial on the Windows side, because you've got to buy Windows licenses for all of this stuff. But especially with Linux, it's just start another virtual machine, install what you need, you're good to go. And you do end up kind of... the number of machines you run does start to snowball.
They're breeding?
Just kind of... yeah, they really do breed. So just expect that if you start down the virtualization route, you will end up with far more virtual machines than you can imagine at the beginning.
So does that mean, like, buy more RAM, basically? I mean...
Well,
yeah,
I guess there's
the
licensing, too, right? With the licensing?
Yeah,
you're only allowed to run three servers, so...
Three hosts, right? With as many guests as you want, right? So.
Oh, yeah, sorry, that's what I... Yeah. Gotcha. Good clarification.
Yeah, when it starts to really snowball, then it starts getting really expensive. But with the really cheap package, you can run three servers with at most two processors in each server, and they can be up to six core processors, so you can have up to 32 cores or something, 36 cores if you max it out, and 256 meg of RAM in each server, so you can have three really powerful servers. And on those,
they have
if you max it out,
RAM limitation. I don't understand that RAM limitation. Is that just so they can charge you more for more RAM, or...?
Yeah, pretty much. By limiting 256 meg, you can run... 256 gig. You can run lots of servers in that.
But if you were running a Windows 7 server, you would not run a Windows 7 server with less than 1 gigabyte of RAM.
Yeah, he was just saying megs, and I was confused, but he meant gigs.
Right.
So we got that.
Yeah.
Okay. But going back to that, though, that means that effectively you're limited to 256 Windows 7 servers on the RAM side, basically, because, you know, it would be insane to run any of those without 1 gig of RAM. So it's kind of a way that they can cap you down.
Yeah, but
that's way past the processor limit, though. But yeah, I got you.
Maxed out, you could run hundreds of virtual machines on this, and depending on what they're doing. If these virtual machines are compiling source code or running massive mail servers, then you're going to hit problems a lot sooner.
Then you're
going
to
hit
CPU limitations versus RAM limitations. And then the other thing that you can hit is hard drive limitations. Specifically, if you're using a Drobo, you'll start hitting limitations at about one VM. So there you go.
I'm sensing some problems with Drobos.
Yeah, Drobo and I have had some choice words.
Well, again, you were kind of taking something that was built for a very specific task and trying to make it do something completely different.
That's true.
So, Neil, I'm curious. You mentioned your other server, one of the other big ones you're running is your SQL server, and I guess without, you know, worrying too much about the detail, I assume you have a decent-sized database that, you know, your organization uses however many users, and I'm curious, is that probably the most intensive virtual machine you're running, or as far as like consumption of hardware or resources, or would you say compared to the small business Windows and stuff?
Probably yes. I don't think it's going to be that much more than the small business.
Gotcha.
I mean, the database is a PostgreSQL database. It's about 30 or 40 gig of data in the database, so it's not tiny, but not huge. And that's connected to a proprietary program that we purchased for dealing with basically our business selling holidays. So it contains all the customers' details, where they're going, when they're going, contracts, that kind of thing.
And was that the reason that you chose Postgre, was because it required it? I was just wondering why you didn't go with MySQL.
It was there when I started. The company that made the program we used just said we needed two servers, and they installed the application server and the database server.
I see.
Before I started, so they only support this one database as the back end.
And when you got there, I'm assuming that you weren't running any virtualization and you kind of set this all up. And so when you kind of went to your boss and you said, hey, I want to put a virtual machine on our network, did they know what that was?
They didn't have a clue. I mean, to be honest, I didn't have that much faith in ESX at the beginning, just because I hadn't used it and hadn't heard anything bad about it. So I started off, got the free version, stuck it on a spare hard drive, and virtualized a couple of machines I didn't really care that much about, mainly to free up the space. There's kind of piles of desktops in the server room doing various jobs. Started virtualizing those. And it just kind of snowballed. I got a slightly better server for it, virtualized a few more things. Because it'd been running fine for 6 months, I switched to a more important system into it, bought a bit more hardware, and it just kept going like that. And now pretty much everything is running in VMware.
And were you doing physical to virtual conversions? And tell me about that if you were.
Yeah, I did a couple of those. There's two ways of getting a virtual machine running. You can either do the start from scratch, stick an install CD into the virtual machine, boot install just as you would with an actual piece of hardware. If you've already got a machine running, VMware provides a couple of programs that you can install on the virtual, on the actual original source machine, and that will copy the entire contents of the virtual machine into a virtual machine on the fly
while it's running,
and change anything that it does it while it's running.
Wow!
But you don't really want to be using it, because you can do it with a Exchange server or something, but then you've got the trouble of it starts doing the copy. Any emails received by the real server aren't then, while it's doing the copy, aren't going to be on the virtual server. But yeah, you basically just, you've got the machine running, log into it. Probably best to shut down as much as you can to simplify things. Start this program, say convert into that virtual server over there, that storage device, give it this much RAM, go. And it just starts copying everything out of the machine over the network, putting it into the virtual machine. Changes all the drivers and everything that needed to be changed. Because, of course, from the real hardware to the virtual hardware, everything, the network card, the chipset controllers, is going to be different. And it deals with all of that for you. Boot the machine up on the virtual machine side, and it all just works fine. The only thing you'll probably get is Windows popping up and saying, hardware's changed, need to reactivate.
Did you run into that yourself? I'm sorry, Mary.
I didn't really know about that, but that sounds like a very cool option to have if you wanted to be moving any amount of computers into a virtual environment. And I guess in your experience, that tool has worked pretty well.
Yeah, that has worked pretty well. The other way they do it is they give you a live CD, so you can boot the machine from a live CD and use that to copy everything over the network. So it just takes the guest operating system out of the equation, as it were. And that's the way I actually did our small business server about 4 or 5 months ago now, just because the idea of trying to do it with the server on, a little bit nervous.
Yeah.
But gosh. I virtualized other systems using that, and it worked fine, no problems.
Hmm. And when you say live CD, you mean bootable CD, just to clear that?
Yeah, it's a, okay. Just an ISO you can download, burn it on CD, cool. Stick it in the drive, boots from it.
Gotcha.
And you get a little, it's a, the Windows pre-installation environment type setup that runs from the CD, and it just boots straight into the VMware program. You tell it you want cool. to back up this virtual machine, give it the IP address of the server it's going to.
I'm a little bit curious now about all this virtualization. We've been talking about it enough. Just like we talked about COMAC layout enough that Ben started just playing around with that, I'm eyeing this this Core i7 machine that's my desktop and thinking it's not really being used as much as it could be right now. I might need to do a little virtualization of my desktop here just to have some other things running in the background. I don't know. I'm a little
Sam
kind of
had that same thing too, right, Sam?
Yes, definitely.
Did you start down that road yet, or no?
Yeah, I'm trying to. I keep running into problems, Ben. I'll tell you all about it.
which suite did you go? Are you trying the ones Ben, Zen Server, the one Ben is using, or?
Yeah, I'm gonna probably go with Zen Server first and gotcha. See how that goes. I'm basically waiting for a catastrophe to happen at work before I start virtualizing everything. Right now, Neil, what I have at work is just everything's basically its own computer, just because I don't know. When I first started there in like 2002 or whatever, nobody was really virtualizing anything, and then it just never occurred to me, and so everything is basically its own box, and you know it's all backed up, and there's been no catastrophe, there's been no turning point for me to like have a need to start over, and so I'm kind of waiting for some hardware to die or something that I can you know, but it never happens, you know, I'm waiting. Hard drive to crash or motherboard.
Yeah, if you want it to happen, it's not going to.
Yeah, so I guess as long as I keep that attitude, I'll never need to. Nice. But
So, are there any subjects you want to cover on? any last subjects, Sam or Neil? Yeah.
Yeah. How many computers, Neil, do you have that are running Windows? Any version of Windows that are virtualized?
About four.
Okay, and so do you have a Windows update server, the WinSXX server running, or do you just update them manually whenever you get around to it?
What we tend to do is wait for a couple of days after the Microsoft
Tuesday
patch Tuesday.
Right.
So sometime later that week, we'll come in early and just update all the servers. Reboot all the servers just to check that everything's still working and they still boot properly and all the rest of it. So I did try having WSUS running for a while, but it was a bit fiddly and there was no real benefit. We've got a nice fast internet connection, so it was easier just to use Microsoft servers, get them straight from Windows Update.
Right. I read a bit about that when I was going to take a job administering a huge network for the YMCA like 5 years ago, and they had a network going in the back room that was enormous with a T1 line going in, and nobody knew how it worked. Nobody. I said, well, who's in charge of this? And this guy who was the director of education, he goes, I am. I'm like, okay. And this guy didn't know anything about it. He's like, nobody goes in here, nobody touches anything, but the problem is it's running Windows stuff. I'm like, so it needs to be updated. You can't just leave it alone. It's not Linux, you know? So I'm like, well, someone's got to like, you know, get in there and figure out how it's administered. And like, there was no documentation. Nobody had left any notes behind, just tons of switches and a whole bunch of computers. And so that was when I learned about the that you could have your own Windows Update server locally. You know,
wow, on. Did you take that on? Did you jump in there and just
no,
start
they,
digging?
No, I started, I... they had offered me the position, and I expressed interest in it, and then they, like, someone higher up decided to close down that entire office. So they actually closed down the whole building and moved everything elsewhere. So I don't even know what ended up happening with that.
I was gonna say that sounds like a crazy story to jump into something like that.
Yeah, that's I taught myself about all sorts of Microsoft stuff at that point, and it was like, you know, because I really didn't want to go in there and like unplug the wrong thing or change the wrong, you know, settings in Active Directory. That would have been a real mess. So, but I've always been interested in the Windows Update Server, because every time you end up getting onto a new set of computers that are on a local area network that all need to be updated, it's like, come on, you know, you got to reboot like 5 times and wait around for it. It's a lot of waiting around, you know.
Yeah, especially if it's downloading everything over a slow internet connection each time.
Yeah, and you're waiting. And it's never long enough where you can leave for a while. It's no, it's that just the right period of time where I'm standing staring at it, and I'm like, Jesus.
I don't have time to go get a coffee around the street, but I am also bored of standing here staring at the stupid monitor.
Right. Just stupid. The wrong amount of time, basically. Ben, did you want to get into the side channels again?
All right. So last episode, was it last episode we talked about side channels? I think it was.
Yes.
So many episodes. And Neil posted in the comments about a side channel that he remembered kind of from a while back. Neil, you want to talk about the blinking LEDs?
Yeah, I'm pretty impressed that you actually found the link to this, because I vaguely remembered it. Going back to the old dial-up modems, with the little status LEDs blinking away saying where the data was going backwards and forwards. The modems normally just connected the data channel straight to the LED. So by watching the LED, you could see the raw ones and zeros going through the modem. And there was actually kind of... someone proved this up to 56 kilobits per second modems.
That's crazy.
So it's, yeah, a little bit... scary. Someone across the street can just look at the modem in the window of the shop opposite and see what they're doing.
And pull every single bit that's going out over your internet connection, something that you thought was, you know, secure or whatever. The thing of that sucks about this, though, is that it does not apply to DSL modems, and it doesn't apply to basically anything faster. Also, something that is interesting is that pretty much every network card has a little bit of a light on the back, every Ethernet card, and in this little guide, none of the Ethernet cards were found to be affected. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm guessing the data rate's just too fast.
Yeah, a 56K, I didn't even know that was that slow, but... Is anyone else surprised that the data is that slow at 56K?
Well, the thing is I was trying to look at the response times for an LED, and I couldn't really find a good response time. But basically, the response time measures the time from when the LED is completely on to either all the way off, or you could almost say -3 dB, which basically is a measurement of when it's pretty good. It's 50% off or something like that. But if I couldn't find a really good answer, but if I was able to find it, then I could tell you what the maximum bit rate you could transmit over an LED and still read it is. And then the other thing is that even if you're sending data faster than the response time, the LED is still going to be lighting up lighter and dimmer. So you might even be able to send more data and still read it back, even though the LED doesn't get all the way bright or all the way dim, just because you can still see the pulses. Basically, LEDs can pump out data like super fast. I haven't really talked about this on the podcast, but my senior project in college was to build a robot, and we can definitely talk about that in the future. But I built my own circuit board, I had LEDs, I had my own CPU and everything. And we had written a little routine that was blinking the red LED extremely fast. You know, basically, I don't know, it was microseconds or something like that. And to me, it just looked solid. But my teacher said, oh, no, it's blinking. And I said, what? I was like, how did you tell that it's blinking? And this is what he said. He said, look to the left of the LED and then look to the right of the LED. And as your eyes move over in that single look, you'll actually see the strobes of the LED going dit, 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 dit. And you'll see it in your eyeball. So you can actually see the effect. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I've noticed that before in random places and times. You'll see sometimes they have video equipment. We'll be taking video of, you know, a CRT screen, and you'll see the line kind of shifting down the CRT screen, and it has to do with the refresh rates. And
right.
Kind of like you just mentioned, your LED, that had a very high refresh rate, but if you did a little eye trick, you could see it. And that's the same with monitors, too. If you wave your hand in front of your monitor you're sitting at right now, it'll look kind of weird, and it has to do with refresh rate and light blinking.
You're using a CRT, Mary?
No. Any monitor. I didn't explain that fully.
All right. So the next kind of side channel, we're kind of doing a little revisiting on the side channels here. I believe it was Antonio mentioned Van Eck Freaking. And last week we talked about a side channel where you were allowed to attack a CRT monitor by just looking at the reflection on the wall and looking at the phosphor response time of the phosphor, honestly, and being able to re-digitize the data. Van Eck Freaking is very similar, except for the fact that instead of looking at the light of the monitor, you're looking at electromagnetic radiation. So basically that's radio waves. Going kind of into hardware, any time that you have a wire and you put electricity through it, that is an antenna, and it's radiating radio waves. So any wire, your mouse wire, your keyboard wire, your video wire, all of the wires on your entire computer are all radiating tiny bits of electromagnetic radiation. And your monitor is kind of like a big production, right? There's a lot of light and energy and things that need to be, you know, processed so that you actually get pixels on your screen. So you get a large byproduct of radiation. So Van Eck Freaking is very similar, except for the fact that you're listening with a radio tuner to the tiny little signals that the monitor is producing, and you're able to, I think, reconstruct parts or all of the original pixels. The very scary thing about Van Eck Freaking is that it applies to LCD monitors as well. So you're not safe from this just because you got rid of your old CRT.
That's intriguing. I kind of wonder what distances you would be able to, what kind of equipment you would need, A, and B, what kind of distances this equipment would have to be from the source. I'm very curious.
Yeah, I don't know much about it, but I do know that it probably would be possible. Like, for instance, in my room, on the other side of the wall, my monitor is up against the wall. On the other side of the wall is outside of the house, right? Mm-hmm. I bet you if you were standing outside my house, you could definitely pick up some good signals.
Yeah, with some high-end equipment.
And I wouldn't even know because I don't really have a window on that side, right? Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. I mean, it says here that they had equipment for the university for less than $2,000 to pick up the stuff on the LCD, so.
Wow.
I don't know. I'd be interested to see what that equipment is.
That was to pick it up. Was that actually able to decode anything out of the signal, though?
No.
Or was that just proof of concept? They could see a signal.
I'm looking here on the Wikipedia entry that Ben posted in the notes. It said in April 2004, new academic research has revealed that the flat panel and laptop displays are also vulnerable to electromagnetic eavesdropping. The required equipment for espionage was constructed in a university lab for less than $2,000. So I have to check the...
So that means everything for $2,000.
Citation.
Yeah.
Scary.
So for Merrick's side channel defense on this one, what we're going to do is similar to our CRT tactic. We're going to have a flat screen behind your monitor with arbitrary stuff, maybe Blade Runner playing on it. That'd be fine.
Right, why not?
And then maybe something else that, depending on how paranoid you are, you could just stack the flat screens all around you and only have what you're working on shift between monitors at random times. And then you just turn to that new monitor and start working on that
one. For the first one, of course, it's duct tape. That's easy, right? Just cover the LEDs, right? On the blinking LEDs, right?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I was focusing solely on the EM leakage from flat panels and such.
All right. And the next kind of side channel, which I did not bring up, but I thought I would visit very closely or very shortly, is acoustic. So basically, if we all should click on this link, there's a lot of... there's a lot of graphs, but if you scroll down, you can honestly do a control F, but the title says Loops of CPU Operations. So if you guys scroll down to here, on the right side, you see HLT, MUL, FMUL, ADD, etc., etc. This first graph with all the operations on the right side, it shows kind of the noise that your computer makes. So in your CPU, There's tiny little capacitors all over the place. That's kind of how the CPU was built on silicon. And what these guys did is they put a microphone in next to your box, and they just listen to the noise that your CPU makes. Now most of these frequencies are way above audible. I mean, I don't know what the right word would be, but humans can't hear them.
Human hearing range, right?
But they are still being emitted. And so this guide basically is like a statistical breakdown of what your computer sounds like for each operation. So there's a multiply, there's an add, there's a floating point multiply, there's no op. No op has a certain sound. I don't know what HLT is, but it seems like that makes a lot of noise. I don't know if you guys are looking at this or not.
Yeah, I see it. This is crazy. Especially because in comparison to our triangulation keyboard attack, you would only need one microphone,
right,
and it would only need to be near the box,
right,
not so much the desk or the keyboard. And how many times do people's computers end up in random places in the offices
where a mic could
be easily stashed?
Exactly.
Interesting.
It's very interesting. I mean, the solution for this could just be running a fan or running another speaker that just was generating things on these frequencies randomly.
And in addition, earlier today, sorry to interrupt, I was listening to episode number 10, and the part where you guys were talking about epoxying the RAM in place made me laugh again as I heard that. And a lot of our little paranoias and defenses that we were talked about, what we should mention is the obvious. If your computer system is under lock and key, and no one ever has access to it besides trusted users, then you don't have to glue anything down, or you don't have to scan for microphones or all this other crazy shit. I mean, the first and the basic security steps will go quite a long ways before you have to worry about some of these problems.
Yeah, you'd have to get someone pretty big after you.
Definitely.
Using these kind of attacks against you.
You have to consider yourself a high-profile target. I mean, some people are naturally paranoid, and that's okay, but, your average end user, you definitely don't need to worry about this stuff.
Well, Merrick, that would be you. I mean, you have to worry about the homeless armies coming after you.
Well, that's a different problem that we're going to talk about in the later episode. And by no means would they ever have the organization
How do you
to actually
know? How
form
do you
ranks.
Know, Merrick? They're homeless. They're,
I know.
They're shifty.
They do not form ranks. It's guerrilla operations, and that's much more insidious. Anyways.
Well, great. I mean, Neil, thank you so much for coming on. You are our first listener, basically on the show. That's really amazing. You have a blog. You want to pimp that?
It's basically just somewhere I stick notes of things I want to remember. So it's got a few techies things on there. It's got loads of stuff about Veeam, VMware, how to do sneaky little things to try and do backups of running virtual machines on the free version, which is a nasty hack but seems to work somehow. It's just digitallama.net. There's three L's in the middle, of course, because Llama's got two L's.
The beginning.
And digital's got one, so kind of confuses people, but if we can stick a note in the
of course.
Show notes,
yes,
that'd
we
be
will. We will certainly put a note to your website. Thank you so much. You've been posting great comments on our site. And kind of when we started this podcast, we weren't really sure what was going to happen, how many listeners we were going to have, and things like that. And the kind of users like you that always post really keep us excited and excited to do the next episode.
And motivated.
Yep. Without that, it'd just be three dudes talking to each other, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah, and you know what that means. No, but definitely, it was great to meet you, Neil, and I'm glad, everything Ben said, it's the same for me. It was awesome to have you on the show.
Yeah, it was a great podcast, and it was a privilege to join you guys for this one.
All right, thank you very much. We'll talk to you next time, Neil. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
So it looks like we might be running short on time, and we want to shift our Bitcoin coverage to a future episode. And in the meantime, we're going to talk a little bit about Zen Server IntelliJ. telecache, right?
That's right. So before we jump right into the telecache, you guys might notice a little bit of a change in the audio quality, and that is because of a thing called triple ending. And I know that might sound sexual, but believe me, it's not. The way that we record the podcast here is a little bit of an insight into how things are done, is we all run recording software on our own computers here, and then when we're done with the show, the software breaks apart. It's called this side and the other side. And so for my computer, I have a wave for just my voice, and then I have Merrick and Sam mashed together in a wave. And each of the members of the podcast has the same thing. So we all send, they all send me the wave of just their voice, and then I put them together. I kind of align the time, and we get high-quality audio without having to worry about the audio being processed through Skype. The cheap, basic way to do that would be to just record Skype on this end. Don't worry about any of the editing. Screw it, whatever. And again, there's some problems that come together with that. Basically, the levels aren't always going to be right, and if someone makes a large noise and I want to edit it out, let's say, you know, Merrick drops something and Sam's talking, no offense, Merrick or Sam, I can't cut it out because I don't have those audio seams separate. So triple ending allows all of this magic to happen. The problem is we wanted to interview Neil, and we don't want to, every time we interview someone, we don't want to set them up with the audio recording software, uploading waves. We didn't want it to just be simple. So we have to drop our triple ending for that. So that would be the reason why the audio was sucky and now hopefully is better. Mind you, I'm talking in the future about things that have not yet happened, so we'll see about how that all works.
And in case you missed what Ben was alluding to there is, Sam, you need to stop talking, and I need to stop dropping shit.
Basically, that's what it comes down to.
Pretty
that's
much what he's trying to say there.
So ZenServer and IntelliCache. We just finished talking with Neil about the fact that his infrastructure at his work is not using shared storage. In my setup, I am using shared storage, and so what that means is that I can... what that means is that both of the hosts can see the same disk on the network. So that has some benefits. Basically, as he was saying, if I want to move a virtual machine from one host to the other, I just shut it down, and then I right-click and I say start on machine B, if it was on machine A before. Kind of the problem with virtualization is that the more virtual machines you add, honestly, the resource that you use the most is your disk I/O. And one thing that Neil was saying was that he kind of makes a new VM for everything, and we didn't really get to discuss it. But one of the bad things about making a new VM for every separate service is that you've got an entire operating system, and sometimes Windows, which is, you know, really bloated, that's just doing nothing. The operating system is there basically doing nothing, and all that really matters is the service. But because it's an operating system, it's still causing disk IOs to happen and blah, blah, blah. So your disk IOs actually go through the roof. And so this is a big problem. So just because you're scaling up your infrastructure, you know, you're adding more VMs, you're adding more RAM, you're adding more CPUs, really the most expensive part is your disk IOs and your shared storage. I heard a quote from Citrix that your shared storage cost is about 40% of your infrastructure. I mean, that's a lot, just hard drives, right? And another thing is that people don't always pay attention to their shared storage. They just add more VMs, they add more RAM, and it kind of comes back and bites you later. So ZenServer in the most recent release, which is 5.6 Feature Pack 2, or maybe SP2, something like that. No, it's SP2 now. I'm sorry, I'm getting my versions mixed up. They offer this feature called IntelliCache. Now, IntelliCache basically blows my mind because it makes things like Drobo possible. Once again, don't try Drobo. It's not worth it. but what this does is this allows you to choose a hard drive local on the host, and basically you designate this as a cache. So all of the reads that you make from the shared storage get cached on the local machine. So if you were to read that same file again, instead of sending an I/O operation out over your network card to some hard drive running, you know, attached on some other box, you just hit the local storage. And the other nice thing is that writes are also cached locally. So let's say you were overwriting the same file 10 times with different data. If you did that really quickly, all of those writes would be cached on the local storage, and then after a while, only one of those versions would get synced back to your network storage. So in the case where you're writing things over and over and over, you save a lot of IOs on your network storage. And the cool thing is that local disks are really cheap, whereas shared storage is very expensive. So using the Zen Server IntelliCache feature is very beneficial.
That's cool. I like the sound of it. I guess earlier when you were talking about the disk IO, so as maybe a solution, not necessarily a solution, but to mitigate, would SSDs, you know, help out
Certainly.
In this situation?
So the problem is that you want a network attached SSD. So okay. Not everyone's going to have that. Maybe some people will, you know, have it or, you know, or whatever. But the other thing is that it's very expensive. So it's kind of like, well, what do you want to put your SSDs on? Kind of like, you know, do you want to put, or what do you want to put on your SSDs, rather? Do you want to put your database on there? You want to put all of your operating system on there? And like, you can get smart. Like, you can partition it off. So you've got your operating system, which is running on a slow hard drive, and then all of your database or your email server, or not your server, but your emails themselves or things like that, on the SSD, and that'll give you faster speeds. But there's another thing that's besides speed, which is a big issue here. I've been saying IO operations, but there's actually an abbreviation. It's called IOPS. It stands for IO operations per second. And one of the ways that you can swamp and shut down your network storage is by reading thousands of tiny little reads. Right? Now, we're not talking about the big fat reads. We're talking about little tiny ones. And so with your SSD solution, Merrick, it's not always going to fix it, because if it's on the network, it means that there needs to be a CPU that translates the reads from the disk into network packets and then sends them out to you, right? So that CPU can be the bottleneck. And the problem is not just throughput, it's also I/O operations per second. And as you can imagine
And even with all the, you know, the craziest hardware money could buy, there's still latency in the network that would add up to a problem if you had a bunch of these small writes, I assume.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, I see what you're getting at. I see.
So, one of the things, I'll tell you how to enable IntelliCache just right now, but one of the things that's annoying about Zen Server is you have to go to the command line for everything. It's kind of annoying. Like, there's some things that they put in the UI, and there's some things they didn't. In Zen Server, every hard drive and every VM has a UUID, which is kind of like the UDID, like the UDID, which from iOS, but it's different. Basically, it's like, I don't know, 20 characters long, and it looks like gibberish, but it's supposed to be a unique universal identifier. So no two hard drives will have the same one on your hard drive. It's on your system. No two VMs are going to have the same UUID. It's like a serial number, right? So if I want to find the UUID for my VM, I just click properties. There's my UUID, right? But if I want to find the UUID for my virtual hard drive, I have to go to Linux. It doesn't really make sense that I can't get that in the interface.
So from what you're saying, it seems like there would be a market for an aftermarket GUI utility.
And you know, they do allow you to write C programs in that drop in the GUI. So I think that I honestly want to play with that a little bit, because I could make my life so much easier just by being able to right-click and copy the UUID to clipboard. I mean, come on.
Above and beyond, you could turn it into something you could either, you know, open source or turn it into a product, whichever way you took
it. Right. I mean, I can make it like a $25 product, and I know that lots of people would buy that because, there's people that use the free version, there's people who use the enterprise version. I think there was a survey, and there's a lot of people using the free version. Like, I don't want to say the percentage because I don't remember exactly, but it was more than like 30 or 40%.
Is the enterprise GUI any different or no?
I don't think so. They have a lot more features, but the GUI is not much different. So they kind of are lazy on that.
Huh.
So the way you set up IntelliCache is you need to have a local storage set up in your box. I'm not going to talk about that, but once again, lots of Linux GUI stuff. So basically the command that you want is host enable local storage caching. And I don't have the exact command for this, but I can put it in the show notes. And so basically you tell the Zen server, I want you to use this disk for storage caching. And then what you need to do is for every single hard drive that you want to have IntelliCache on, you need to set, you need to say allow caching equals true, and then put in the UDID or the UUID. And once you do that, once you boot your VM, you'll notice incredible increases in speed, because a lot of the writes are done to the local disk, and a lot of the reads are basically cached locally. And the coolest part is the first time you boot it, not that much of a speed increase, although it is there. But once you shut the machine down and reboot again, it's like night and day, right? Because it's already cached all the reads, etc. You know, it's ready to go.
Right. Can you adjust sort of to the threshold of how much it's going to cache?
I think it caches everything as long as there's disk space. And if it runs out of disk space, so everything's cached. Because the thing is that every time you're doing a read, you have to hit the shared storage anyways. Mm-hmm. So there's no reason not to just write it down to the local disk and save yourself hitting that.
Right. Why not?
There's some things that kind of concern me about IntelliCache. Like, I was able to sort of break it a little bit. I don't quite remember exactly what I did, but it was something to the effect of it was writing a large file and then shutting down the machine. And then I migrated the machine to another host, which didn't have the IntelliCache. And the file was gone, right? So that's the problem, is that the cache is only local per host. So if you start a machine on host A, and it's all cached up, it's ready to go, it's running really quickly, and then you shut it down and start it on B, it's going to be slow because it has to rebuild the cache back up.
Okay. Hmm. What are some of the reasons why you'd be moving a VM around between different hosts?
So one of the reasons that we switched to virtualization was to remove hardware failure from the equation of your servers. If you have a CPU blow, if you have RAM blow, you don't want that to stop your servers from working. I know that's kind of crazy to think about, right? You know, I just blew my CPU, but my server still works, right? I mean, that's not possible. So the way that you do that is by pooling your resources together. So Zen Server has something called a pool, and in the pool you have X number of hosts. So the reason you'd want to migrate from one to the other is that your server blew up and just turned off, right? So... Right. In that state, what you do is you take all the VMs that were running on that had crashed, and you basically start them on your remaining hardware. The other thing that you can do is if you want to move servers around or you want to upgrade network cards or things like that, you shut down all the VMs on the hardware you want to upgrade, start them on your other hosts, and then you're free to do whatever you want because that box isn't running anything vital.
Does Zen Server come with scripts automatically to do this for you? Like, does it know like when a host is unexpectedly shut down?
And it does. It does do that, and that is part of the disaster recovery. However, you have to pay for the more expensive versions of Zen Server to be able to do that. So one of the things that Neil was talking about a little bit was high availability. And since we don't pay for Zen Server, I don't know exactly how that works, but I've heard it explained to me, and I'll say a little thing about it. Basically, high availability has a clone of the VM running on another piece of hardware. So you've got a master running, which is doing all the data and serving all the data out, right? But then you have a clone running somewhere else that's dormant. And I believe how it works is that all of the memory writes are sent over to the clone. So anytime you're writing to RAM, you mirror it over to the clone. And then anytime you're running to a hard drive, it's a shared storage, so the clone can also read from the hard drive, right? So when your master blows up, the clone immediately kicks in, and without any downtime, you've got all of the same data, and you're ready to go. And it's pretty cool, because I guess when you turn on high availability, it's like a checkbox, or I don't know, it's a button or something, Zen Server makes a plan. It literally plans out, okay, these are the resources I have. If this fails, it goes here. If this fails, it goes here. You know, if this fails, this is what happens. And kind of one of the things about high availability is that it's like instant. Like it just kicks on. You don't really get a choice. So if you were going to be doing some maintenance on your servers, like taking them down for your own reasons, right, you have to turn high availability off. Because if you don't, it's going to mess with you. If you try to do anything like, oh, I mean to turn the server off, it's going to say, oh, failover, instantly, let's run this other guy. Like, you don't get a choice. It's happening. Your server's going to be up no matter what, right? So, on almost all...
What if you did that and then changed something on the primary that's interesting, and then brought it back online, do you think it would try to recruit it back into the
I think it would break your high availability, right? Because now you're running on the clone. I mean, yeah. The other thing that it might do is it might reject the master changes and say the master is now the clone, right? Because you've switched roles. I mean, I'm not exactly sure. It is a good question, though, right?
Yeah, totally hypothetical, but yeah.
And so all the documentation online says, before you do this, turn off high availability.
Just turn it off.
Before you do it, turn it off. And it says, if you're doing this and high availability is on, it's not going to work. It won't let you do it or, you know, whatever.
Okay, I see. That makes sense.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's right. That basically, I mean, if you want to say a little bit more, Sam.
No, that's it.
So basically, in IntelliCache, the basic gist of that is that it allows you to use cheap local storage to prevent IOPS from hitting your network storage, and you can actually scale up a lot larger because of that. Also, if you're doing things like running multiple VMs that are clones of each other, Zen Desktop is something like this, where you can allow everyone in your work to be using at their desktop machine, they're actually running a VM, which is a whole other subject which I actually don't know much about. The IntelliCache works really well because all the employees are running clones of each other. Basically, they clone from one basic machine, right? So with the IntelliCache, the cloning set up properly, you can cache, let's say, five machines at once, even though you're only caching one hard drive, because Zen Server knows that those hard drives were all cloned from each other, and therefore they're very similar. So when it just caches the base image, if that makes sense.
So I guess the bulk of the data stays the same, but individual user stuff is differed.
It's different.
Then only those differences are kept.
Exactly. But if you cache the base image, right, you save yourself a huge amount of bandwidth because you don't need to basically multiply that and then hit your storage attached, your network attached storage.
To mention the huge advantage of not having a specific actual piece of hardware for every user.
Exactly. Zen Desktop is something which I can research and talk about, but I actually don't have a place I could use it. I mean, I could try it at my home or something, but you know, it's I believe it's free. I'm not sure.
Here's a cool opportunity if we happen to have a listener that has any experience on this topic. You know,
please write us on the website. Quick note about Bitcoin. I know we're not going to talk about it, but I added a donation page to Port Forward Podcast. If you look at the top, just click donations. The reason I added this was because I had a listener demanding that he be able to donate us money. So thank you very much to Mr. Mike Shaw. He graciously made us have a donation page, so I can't really control that. you know, what the listeners want, they get. But I also put our Bitcoin address up there, so if you want to send us donations via Bitcoin, that is totally welcome as well. Also, we have PayPal up on the website. So I just wanted to mention that before we wrap things up.
Real quick, how is Zen Server Desktop different than thin clients?
It's the same. It's the same concept. Okay. It's different because it's virtualized. Whereas thin clients in the day used to be one mega epic server, and then basically people were running a session on the server, right?
Right. That's always assume that they're using just sessions within like RDP or something.
Right, something like that, right? Where now the new way to do it is you get your full own computer where you can do whatever you want to it.
Right, gotcha.
So that's a...
So what hardware do you interface on then? Do you know, like, with the... For, you know, you're adding a user, what do you need to put on their desk? I guess
What you need to put on their desk is basically anything that can run... I think it's Windows. Basically, it has to be able to run Windows XP. So Windows XP was released in, like, 2001, right? So
yeah, I think it's like, you know, 256 megs RAM.
Basically. And the nice thing is you can scale up your workload, right, without having to scale up all your clients. All you need to do is just put beefier servers in there. I mean, you can put people on pretty craptastic hardware, and it'll still run Zen Server just fine.
That's cool.
It's a really cool concept. I'd love to know more about it, but I just don't have the number of users to make that something like that happen.
Well, again, you might not have to worry about it.
Yep. Well, we're sorry we couldn't cover Bitcoin this episode, but we will get to it next episode.
We'll do it. We will.
Maybe.
We'll do it hard and dirty, and it'll be awesome.
Yep. Thank you guys so much for listening to the Port Forward Podcast. Our contact email is packets@portforwardpodcast.com. If you guys would like to send us stories that you loved, or, you know, things you want us to talk about, or cool things you found on the internet, please send them there. If you want us, also, you can leave a comment on the website. A good place would be to put it would be on the most recent show notes and say, hey, why don't you talk about this on the next show? And our website again is www.portforwardpodcast.com. Please subscribe to us using the RSS link or using your pod catcher of choice. And thank you so much for listening. Bye.
Bye.
See ya.
I totally have an old MS IntelliMouse laser backup in my PC junk drawer, though.
I consider an old IntelliMouse to have one with a ball. But hey, that's just me.
Well, yeah. But yeah. You were talking about mice back before you had one, which is, Jesus.
That's hilarious. I can't even.
I think I was playing with sticks in the woods then with the other kids. And you were fucking around on the command line, or keyboard already. That's awesome.
So if I
guess
overlay
what?
The waves.
I got 0.0001 Bitcoin, bitches.
Dude, me too.
Oh, you got two? Shit.
Dude, I was totally...
$17 or something right now.
Are you in a pool right now?
No, I haven't actually started mining. I just went to that the Bitcoin faucet. Yeah, I tried that.
Oh, that's dude, funny. I fucking mined for my 0.001 Bitcoin.
Look yeah. forward to listening to the episode. Do you know roughly when it's going to be out?
Probably next Tuesday or Wednesday. We got the holiday. This weekend is our 4th of July, our independence from you guys, so...
yeah.
What Ben's trying to say is he's lazy and he's not really going to be working on this for about a week. That's what Ben's trying to say.
So probably a Tuesday or a Wednesday. So we usually record him on Sunday and get him out by Tuesday or Wednesday. In this case, it might be about the same thing. So there you go.
Yep, I'm ready. I haven't got the uptime figures, but they're probably not going to be too impressive because I tend to install updates and reboot each machine once a week anyway.
Right
just
now,
so
Sam,
I know that
I'm at 60 days, dude. 60 days uptime.
What Neil's saying is that he's a responsible IT administrator who does an update.
No, I'm saying I'm a paranoid IT administrator who learnt Windows.
I'm with you on that. My servers usually don't get past 30 days for that exact reason.
Yeah, it's a problem. It used to be Epic where you could have like 2 years uptime, but, you know, yeah.
Linux used to
anyways.
Be.
Well, on Linux. Yeah. Yeah.
Previous place I worked, a couple of servers with two and a half years uptime.
That's crazy.
And it was just one of those things. We never touched those servers just because if you was the one that did something that needed to reboot, you was going to be a laughing stock. Ruined the record.
A little bit about Zen Server and Telecache, and then wait, what's this? Oh, it's a note from the future. I guess Neil says that you actually need a 64-bit CPU to run VMware ESXi. So with that being said, let's get the show started.
What's this? A note from the...
Did it open? Did it sound like I opened a note?
Yes, dude. Oh, it's so funny.
Okay, I hope that's not too late.
It sounds like I opened a note.
Well, I had a piece of paper. I had it all ready to go, dude.
Oh, you don't understand. The way you edit stuff together, it's so funny.